businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. Hope you enjoyed your holiday yesterday. This morning, we have two programs from the Focus 580 archives, and one way or another, get at how we think about gender. In the second hour, a conversation that we had back in August with Julie Phillips, author of a recently published biography of Alice Sheldon, who was perhaps better known to a lot of people with her pen name, James Tiptree Jr. He was one of the most highly regarded science fiction writers of the 70s. People thought for a long time, in fact, that he was a man. Some other science fiction writers praised the work very highly, and when it was suggested that Tiptree could possibly be a woman, they said, no, no way, impossible. Well, in fact, it was. So you can hear that conversation in the second part of the show. Hour one, we'll be talking here, or you will hear me talk, with Dr. Leonard Sachs, author of the book Why Gender Matters, about what science is now learning about the differences between men and women. This is a program first broadcast on August 28th, and as you listen, do keep in mind that this morning, both hours will not be taking your calls. It was not all that long ago, just a couple of decades, that researchers didn't think that boys and girls were really all that different. And they thought that by teaching them the same subjects in the same ways, that gender gaps in achievement would be erased. However, in recent years, scientists have discovered that differences between girls and boys are more profound than anybody had guessed. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we will explore the emerging science of sex differences as we talk with Dr. Leonard Sachs. He is the author of a book entitled Why Gender Matters. It's published in paperback now by Broadway Books. He is both a physician and a psychologist, an MD and PhD. He's a board-certified physician and psychologist. He's also the founder of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education, and as such, often speaks to teachers about gender differences in how children learn. He also advises teachers, principals, and superintendents who are starting single-sex education programs in public schools and classrooms. Dr. Sachs, hello.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it. To begin with, and I think that we're talking about challenging an idea that I think a lot of people still hold on to, I'm sure people who are listening to us, and that basic idea being that the major differences in behavior between men and women or between boys and girls are, for the most part, the result of socialization. That is, it has to do with the kind of job description, so to speak, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman that we give to children. We teach it to them in an overt way. We teach it to them in covert ways. And that's really the reason that, I mean, certainly there are physiological differences, yes. But when you take a look at gender, there are people who argue that this is basically a social construction. How now do you think about that idea?
Well, certainly that's what I was taught. I enrolled in the PhD program at the University of Pennsylvania in psychology back in 1980, and we certainly were taught that gender is socially constructed. Boys learn how to be boys. They learn that boys are supposed to play with trucks and not with dolls, and girls learn that girls are supposed to play with dolls and not with trucks. And there was considerable evidentiary basis for this notion that gender is a social construct, that girls and boys learn from parents, teachers, friends, siblings, what boys and girls are supposed to do. It didn't occur to anyone that the eyes of boys and girls might be built in a fundamentally different way, or that the ears might be built in a fundamentally different way. It didn't occur to anyone even to look at that question. It wasn't until 5 years ago that anyone, in this case Dr. Edwin Leppart, decided to cut open the eyeballs of dead animals to see if the males and females are built differently. It turns out they are. The wiring of the retina, we're not even talking about the brain yet, but the wiring of the retina is profoundly different in males and females. The cochlea is built in an enormously different way in males and females. Again, this is research that was not even imagined 10 years ago. I hosted a symposium last year at the American Psychological Association annual convention where we had the researchers who've actually done this work on sex differences and how men and women see and hear and smell present their findings, I think the presenter got at least the loudest laughs and loudest applause was Dr. Pamela Dalton from Philadelphia. She has studied sex differences in how men and women smell, and she has found that for many, many odors, women have a sense of smell that is 100,000 times more sensitive than any man's. There is no overlap between the distributions. In fact, there's 5 orders of magnitude difference between them. So that the example she gave, for example, man and woman walk into their home after a 2-week vacation, and they enter the kitchen, and the woman says, "Oh, my gosh, something died, and it rotted, and I think I'm going to throw up." And the man says, "I don't smell anything." And the woman says, "We're going to have to hire somebody to tear out the drywall and figure out what's rotting." And the man says, "Hey, I don't smell anything." If they don't understand that men and women experience the world in enormously and profoundly different ways, the woman's going to be quite disgusted. And I've been, as a family physician, I've been on the receiving end of these complaints. The woman will say, "Well, now I know my husband is a farm animal," she will say, "because the place smells like a rotting pig on a manure pile, and he's perfectly comfortable. He's quite at home." And I say, "Look, it's not that he's comfortable with the smell. He doesn't smell it. You can't be angry with him any more than a sighted person can be angry with a blind person." And then the next day, the man comes in and he says, "Well, now I know my wife is a witch," except he doesn't say witch. He uses a different word. He says, "Because she's going on and on, we got to hire a contractor." And I say, "Look, you can't smell it, but the smell is overpowering to her. You can't argue with her any more than a blind person can argue with a sighted person. You will have to hire that contractor." The lack of awareness of sex differences can lead, in this case, to divorce. The lack of awareness of these sex differences in the classroom can lead to all sorts of bad outcomes for both girls and boys. I got into this myself back in the 90s because as a family doctor and psychologist, I saw this parade of boys, boys primarily, coming into my office, first, second, and third grade boys, Justin or Damien or Carlos, and mom or dad, usually mom, waving a slip of paper from the school saying, "We're concerned about your son because he's not paying attention. He clearly has a deficit of attention. Perhaps he has attention deficit." And what I found is that in many cases, those boys did not have ADD. They don't need drugs. They need teachers who understand that boys and girls learn differently, and to begin with, that boys do not hear as well as girls do. That's not a matter of paying attention. That's a matter of the fact that the cochlea is built differently. Girls and boys hear differently from birth, but the differences get bigger as we get older. By the time you're my age, mid-40s, women have a sense of hearing at least an order of magnitude more sensitive than men have on average. So that if you share a car with your wife, she may complain that you've got the radio cranked up too loud, or she may ask why you have the TV turned up so loud. You know, maybe you're deaf. Maybe you should have your hearing tested, because nobody ever told her that there's nothing wrong with her husband. It's just that he's a man. But in any case, Justin is not paying attention. The teacher's observation was absolutely correct. And I, in many cases, I went and sat in the classroom. And even though Justin knows that Dr. Sachs is here with us today to see whether or not Justin is paying attention, he's still not paying attention. The teacher's observation was always accurate. If the teacher says Justin not paying attention, he's not paying attention. But it's not because he has ADD. He doesn't need drugs. He needs the teacher to speak more loudly. It's easy for him to ignore the teacher if he can barely hear her. And I've had many, many boys over the past 10 years who were diagnosed by others as having ADD. But we put them in a room with a teacher who understands how to teach boys, a teacher who's running around the room back and forth and raising her voice, and suddenly that boy doesn't have ADD, and he doesn't need drugs, and he's doing very well. Mm.
Not to put too fine a point on that, but these kind of differences that you talk about, the fact that it seems that women, not seems that, but it is the case that women's hearing is more acute, their sense of smell is more acute, they perhaps process information differently, women do things like they tune into people's faces, and boys focus on movement, and that's something that you see right from the very beginning. In fact, all of these differences are in childhood are in fact even more pronounced. That is, the differences between boys and girls are even more pronounced than are the differences between men and women, adult men and women.
That's an excellent point. In the book, I cite research by Dr. Harriet Hanlon and others at Virginia Tech, who found that the different regions of the brain develop in a different sequence in girls compared with boys, so that by the age of 12, the differences between the brains are quite striking in the areas of the brain involved, for example, with fine motor skills like handwriting or peeling a sticker or culling within the lines. The brain of the 12-year-old boy looks like the brain of the 8-year-old girl. And when I speak at co-ed schools, I say, please do not grade your kids on handwriting, because if you do, and you say to Justin, who's in fourth grade, now, Justin, you know, your handwriting should be on a straight line, should follow a straight line, but yours is going up, and then it's going down. Now, look at Emily. You see how her handwriting's so neat, and it's on a straight line? Look at Rebecca. Look at Melissa. You know, why can't you write more like that? It's as difficult for Justin to write as neat and precise as Emily does in fourth grade as it would be for a second grade girl to write like a fourth grade girl. The brains develop in a different sequence, but it's not the case that girls develop faster in all areas. In many areas of the brain, the boys develop faster. The boys' areas develop faster, for example, geometry or rotating an object in your head. The boys' brains develop earlier. If you teach the same subjects in the same way to girls and boys, by the age of 12, you have girls who think geometry is hard and boys who think poetry is a waste of time. But as you hinted in your question, after 12, 13 years of age, the brains start to grow back together, so that by the time you are an adult means a woman who is 22 years of age, a man who is 30 years of age, and yes, it does take that long, by the time you're looking at adult brains, the differences between the brains are not that dramatic in most areas. In some areas, they continue to be. But in most areas of the brain, the differences between adult man and adult woman are much smaller than the differences between a 12-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl. In our own lives, as adults, you know, we look around our professional world, and we don't see enormous and profound differences between how adult men and adult women learn. And I agree. I don't think there are enormous differences in how adult men and adult women learn. But children are not adults, and people who are not aware of these findings don't have a clue that the best way to teach geometry to 12-year-old girls is profoundly different from the best way to teach geometry to 12-year-old boys. And if you don't understand that, if you ignore those gender differences, the ironic result is you end up reinforcing gender stereotypes. You end up with girls who think geometry is tough, and boys who think handwriting is something girls should worry about.
Let me just very quickly reintroduce the guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Dr. Leonard Sachs. He is a board-certified physician and a psychologist. He is also the founder of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education and is the author of a book titled Why Gender Matters, What Parents and Teachers Need to Know About the Emerging Science of Sex Differences. It is now out in paperback, has been published by Broadway Books, and a lot of the kinds of research that he has here sketched out is dealt with in the book. So if you're interested in that subject, you can take a look at the book, and questions are welcome too. 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. There are a lot of directions we can go in here, but let me cut right to the question about schools, was something that I know you're particularly interested in, and because, as I've said, you're involved in this association arguing for the benefits of single-sex education. Do you think that girls should be taught by women and boys by men?
Certainly not. We've got all sorts of evidence that women can be magnificent teachers of boys, and I've visited a great many boys' schools where some of the most popular and effective teachers are women, and likewise at girls' schools, some of the most popular and effective teachers are men. But what we do know is that women who are going to be teaching boys need some training in how to teach boys, and men who are going to teach girls likewise. Because if women have not had that training, in this country, more than 98% of kindergarten teachers are women. Now, what this research shows is that girls and women learn best in a quiet classroom that is free of distractions. And if that woman has not had training in gender differences, the first thing she's likely to tell her kindergarten and her first grade class is, now, children, I need you all, please, to sit down and be quiet. Justin, why are you standing? You just went to the bathroom. Damien, what's with the wiggling? It's very distracting. Justin, what did I just tell you? Damien, please. Now, boys, look at Emily. Look at Rebecca. Look at Melissa. They're sitting still and being quiet. Is that so much to ask? Well, you know what? For five-year-old boys, it is. For many five-year-old boys, sitting still and being quiet for hours at a time is difficult. Now, 30 years ago, we didn't ask five-year-olds to do that. 30 years ago, kindergarten was about playing duck, duck, goose, or singing in rounds, or finger painting. Not anymore. Today, kindergarten throughout the United States is about learning to read and write. There's been an acceleration of the early elementary curriculum, such that the kindergarten curriculum today looks very much like the first grade curriculum of 30 years ago. And that acceleration took place without any awareness that the brains develop in a profoundly different way, and they're trying to teach a five-year-old boy to read and write in many cases, not all, but in many cases, is like trying to teach a three- or three-and-a-half-year-old girl to read and write. It is not developmentally appropriate. It is not developmentally appropriate to ask these boys to sit still and be quiet. And the message they get very quickly is that, well, as one seven-year-old boy told me at a public school, he said, the only way you can make the teacher happy is to pretend like your butt is glued to the chair. And once boys get the idea that doing well in school is unmasculine, you've really got two and three-quarter strikes against you. Boys don't want to be girls. Girls don't want to be boys. And once boys get this idea that doing well in school means being more like a girl and less like a boy, they tune out.
Mm. And it's also interesting that apparently one of the things you write about is that not only do boys and girls have these very different learning styles, different educational styles, they relate very differently to their teachers, that girls want the teachers to think well of them. And they'll do the work even if it doesn't interest them. Boys, they won't do that. If it interests them, they'll work hard. But if not, they won't. They'll ask for help only as a last resort. And it sounds as if they don't really care as much as the girls do about whether they think the teachers like them or not.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to have a host who actually read the book. That's remarkable, and I really appreciate it. But you're absolutely right. And I was just talking about how important it is for women to understand how boys learn. In the opening of Chapter 5, I tell a true story of a very bright girl in my practice who was encouraged to sign up for advanced placement physics in high school because she had aced advanced placement biology and chemistry. And she had all these advanced placement courses that year, and she looked at the physics homework, did the first eight problems, but the last two she couldn't immediately see how to do. So she went in to ask the teacher, and the teacher looked at her and said, maybe you don't belong in this class. And she said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, I hear how well you've done in the other courses. He said, in biology or chemistry, if you work really hard, you can do real well. But in physics, you've got to have the right kind of mind. If you don't have the right kind of mind, it doesn't matter how hard you work, you won't do well. And she said, how do you know what kind of mind I have? I've only been in your classroom for a few days. And he said, well, I heard you might be the valedictorian. I just don't want to see you lose that by staying in this class if it's not the right class for you. Well, she was absolutely offended and very angry, and she stomped out of the room and dropped the class. Now, there was a man who had had no training in how girls and boys learn differently, how they approach the teacher differently. Girls tend to regard the teacher as a friend and assume that the teacher is their friend until they have evidence to the contrary. And if you're having problems with a homework assignment, you ask your friend how to do it. That teacher, though, was a man. I don't know him, but I would bet that, like most men, he didn't go to the teacher except as a last resort. So he's assuming that this girl has studied and worked on these problems for hours and couldn't figure out how to do them, and he's thinking if she studied the problem for hours and didn't understand it, maybe she doesn't belong in this class. Now, he's mistaken in that belief, but if she were to say, hey, I didn't look at these problems for hours, I barely glanced at them, that wouldn't help. Because now he would think, well, you're not dumb, you're lazy. He needs to learn about gender differences. He needs to understand that the girl may go to you for help as the first step. So what you'd want to do in that context, the correct thing to do, would be to say, well, Emily, can I ask, have you yourself spent 5 or 10 minutes looking at these problems? No? Okay, well, here's what I suggest. Why don't you take a seat here in my office, and I'll work on my stuff. Why don't you spend a few minutes trying to solve those problems? And if you still have a problem, we'll work at it together. But I have a feeling, Emily, that if you look at that problem carefully for a few minutes, you're going to figure it out on your own. That teacher's lack of awareness of sex differences resulted in him pushing this girl out of his physics class. So now he's got 20 boys and 2 girls in his physics class. Again, the lack of awareness of sex differences reinforces gender stereotypes. Because that teacher doesn't understand how girls learn differently, he's literally pushing girls out of his physics class.
We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Others who are listening certainly are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're about midway through here. Callers are welcome, but again, they can help us by trying to keep their comments brief. We'll go to first caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Would you discuss the differences in boys and girls in how the left brain communicates with the right brain, how the corpus callosum is altered before birth, and also how many of the sex difference that you've been mentioning are caused by the sex difference in how that right brain connects to the left brain?
Yes, the caller is kind of giving away his age. 30 years ago, there was a belief that the corpus callosum was bigger in women than in men, and that belief arose because there was good basis in evidence that women tend to use both their hemispheres for many tasks for which men only use one or the other. The notion that the corpus callosum is bigger in women than men turns out to be false, and there are literally dozens of studies over the last 20 years that have demonstrated that. This notion has been quite robust in the popular media, and I'll still pick up Reader's Digest or even Newsweek magazine and find it mentioned there, because it's very appealing. It seems to resonate with the popular consciousness, but it is a myth. It is not the case. Now, the underlying truth, though, is that women and men, boys and girls, do use the brain in very different ways. And one of the sex differences that does persist into adulthood is that in language tasks, men tend to use the left hemisphere, and men tend to use the right hemisphere for spatial tasks. But that whole notion that the left brain is verbal and the right brain is spatial turns out simply not to be true, more or less, in women. With a few disclaimers, women are much more likely to use both hemispheres for both tasks. And when I do these talks, we look at these MRI scans showing that, indeed, both sides of the brain light up when women are doing verbal and spatial tasks. The whole idea of left brain verbal, right brain spatial got enormous support in the 70s and 80s from these studies that we all remember reading that showed these glossy photos of how the left brain would light up with verbal tasks and the right hemisphere would light up with spatial tasks. And many of us remember seeing those in our own university education. But now go back and read those studies again. Read the methods section. Who were the subjects in those studies? They were all men. They didn't have any women in their studies. And you ask the researcher, you contact the researcher, now retired, and say, why don't you have any women in your studies? And they'll say, well, look, we didn't have functional MRI scans. Those didn't really exist until the early 90s. We were using PET scans, positron emission transaxial tomograms, or CAT scans. PET scans use gamma rays. CAT scans use X-rays. Those are ionizing radiation. And, you know, if the woman were pregnant, it might cause birth defects. And you respond to the researcher, you say, you could have asked the woman whether she was pregnant or not. And they'll say, well, you know, sometimes a woman doesn't know whether she's pregnant. They'll give you a variety of excuses. But for whatever reason, those studies didn't include any women. A lot of the things people think they know about the brain, like left brain verbal, right brain spatial, are true only for men. It's only in the last 10 years, truly, that brain researchers have consistently studied both women and men, and they're finding, to their surprise, that the brain of a man and the brain of a woman is as different as an ovary is from a testicle. That is not my analogy, incidentally. I open Chapter 2 with a quote from two women neuroscientists, Dr. Gay Aronoff and Dr. Jennifer Bell, who say essentially that the brain of a man and brain of a woman are as different as an ovary is from a testicle. That's not unique to their belief either. Researchers at University of California, San Diego, have also written that male brain tissue is intrinsically different from female brain tissue. It's just built very differently from the ground up. Now, differences do not imply an order of rank. The fact that male and female brains are different does not mean that men are better at engineering or that girls are better at counseling or psychology. It simply means that they are different. And reporters often say, well, doesn't this mean boys are better than engineering? Doesn't it mean boys' brains are better for certain things? And I say, well, tell me, which is better, an ovary or a testicle? Differences don't imply an order of rank. Whether or not boys are innately better at learning one thing or another is a matter for empirical investigation. My own belief is that there are no hardwired differences in what girls and boys can learn. And many of the girls' schools I work with, for example, Branksome Hall in Toronto, there, at that girls' school, the average SAT math score is 690, the average SAT verbal score is 620. And that's not unusual. You'll find a number of elite girls' schools where the math score is higher than the verbal score. Girls can excel in advanced math, and boys can be poets and artists. Indeed, if you think back over history, there have been a few men who were pretty good at poetry and art. But not much in our generation, because the lack of awareness of sex differences has had the unintended consequence of reinforcing gender stereotypes. And today, most boys think that art and poetry is for girls.
Let's go on. Champaign County is the next, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm pretty skeptical of this entirely, but let me try to address it in a couple of ways. I just Googled science and sex difference and your last name, and I had to go six levels in before I even... Well, I didn't find anything that actually talks about the researchers you just mentioned, so I'll have to ask you to repeat those their names. Let's try this tack. If there's a lot of variation inside a gender, do you advocate tracking inside the gender?
Yeah. This is why education is so important here. As I mentioned earlier, perhaps the caller missed that part. Dr. Patricia Dalton, and I would encourage you to Google her name, found that women have a sense of smell for many, many odors, perhaps most odors, that is 100,000 times more sensitive than any man's. There is no overlap between the distributions. Likewise, in Dr. Lephart's work, there was no overlap in the distribution and the organization of the male retina and the female retina. Now,
What was that last name again, if I can interrupt you?
I'm sorry, whose last name?
I was expecting to find at least some
Dr. Patricia Dalton, D-A-L-T-O-N, a researcher at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, has demonstrated enormous differences in the ability of men and women to detect odors.
Well, the one about the retinal study.
That's Dr. Edwin Lephart. Last name is L-E-P-H-A-R-T. And, of course, all these. I have over 300 scholarly references in the book, including the two that I just cited. And we encourage people to look at those references. But I certainly agree with the caller that this is not widely known. And using Google as a method to investigate it is not what I would recommend, because
it's a start. Let's see. But you're not answering my question about tracking within a gender. If there,
okay,
if
the there longest is a... chapter in the book. Let me interrupt you a moment, because I'm very familiar with this question. The longest chapter in the book has to do with gender atypical boys and gender atypical girls. It's chapter 9. These are boys who would much rather sit and read a book than play a sport, or girls who would much rather wrestle a hog or climb a tree or play soccer rather than play with Barbies. We actually have a great deal of research about gender atypical boys and gender atypical girls, and we are not asserting by any means that all girls learn one way and all boys learn another. What we do know, however, is that the visual system and the hearing system differs enormously in boys and girls, and that those differences are robust with regard to gender differences within genders. There is still no overlap.
Well, that is a related question, but I'm going to have to interrupt you again, because that wasn't the question I asked. I was asking, in the idea of pedagogy, do you want people to be tracked because of their ability to learn? I mean, you're saying that we have to separate, and you've set up this foundation for same-sex education with the idea that people will learn better in these situations, and you have some documentation of that. Now, that puts aside all of the idea that maybe one of the things schools should do is socialize people to interact together, and maybe that there are other values besides just the test scores.
Okay, let's address that. The idea that you suggested is that children who attend co-ed schools are socialized and will be better interacting with the opposite sex than kids who attend single-sex schools. Now, that is a testable hypothesis, and I cite research where they interviewed college students and asked boys and girls, young men, young women, did you date in high school? How many dates did you go on? Did you have an enduring romantic relationship? And these researchers found, to their surprise, that girls and boys at single-sex schools were more likely to date and more likely to have an enduring romantic relationship than girls and boys who attended co-ed schools. They were surprised by that finding, but I was not, because I know that girls and boys at co-ed high schools don't date anymore. For the
this is a self-report system that I question a lot of the methodologies of the studies you're citing, I think, without even having...
I would encourage you to read the research then. We all have different backgrounds, and you may have gone to a high school where the boys and girls dealt very respectfully with one another. The Kaiser Family Foundation found that that is not true nationwide. Nationwide, the most common form of sexual intimacy at co-ed high schools now is oral sex, with the girl on her knees servicing the boys. Now, that would not be, in my judgment, the best way for girls and boys to learn how to interact. At single-sex schools, that is much less common. At single-sex schools, oral sex is unusual, and heavy petting is a more common form of sexual intimacy. People have studied this. The notion that girls and boys will develop more mature relationships by attending co-ed schools actually turns out not to be the case. Again, you may have attended a very enlightened school, but nationwide, what is happening is that girls and boys are depersonalizing the sexual experience. Oral sex with a girl on her knees servicing the boy.
That's because of the school system?
Your assertion was that kids who attend co-ed schools are more likely to be better socialized than kids who attend co-ed schools.
I was not asserting it. I was saying that this is something that could be investigated. You're investigating the actual existing school system, and you're presenting a quote-unquote reform of it. I think there are other reforms that could be proffered that might actually help humanize schools in other ways that don't involve segregation.
The motivation for establishing the association actually was not what you suggest. It was simply a matter of social justice. You know, President George W. Bush graduated from a boys' school. So did Senator John Kerry. So did former Vice President Al Gore.
They're doing great.
The first woman Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, the first woman National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, the first American woman to fly in space, Dr. Sally Ride, the first American woman to lead the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Bernadine Healy, they all graduated from girls' schools. Our point is simply that if these opportunities are available to anyone who can afford $20,000 or $30,000 a year, why should they be prohibited by law to people who don't have that kind of opportunity? And I'm quoting Senator Hillary Clinton in that regard. That was her position when she joined with Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison to pass the statute legalizing single-sex education in July of 2001.
Thanks for letting me go on this long, Dave, but one other thing I sort of discovered on Google that I'd like to know, did you help set up Mercator.net, or is that erroneous?
I've never heard of that website.
Huh.
Mercator? I don't know what that is.
It's a site that boosts your same-sex, and it's a very Catholic site.
It's based out of Australia. How is that spelled?
Mercator. It's named after the guy that makes the maps, you know, Mercator Projection.
Take a look at it.
But anyway, the Google search says that you set it up. I assume that's probably another. There is a lot of erroneous stuff
correct.
On the net, and I think maybe you're involved in producing a lot of it. Thank you.
I can't find a site named Mercator.net. Online right now. But in any case, I have no association with that site, never heard of it.
Other questions are welcome. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me introduce again our guest. Dr. Leonard Sachs is a board-certified physician and a psychologist. He is the founder of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education. He has his Ph.D. in psychology from University of Pennsylvania. He also earned his M.D. at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, has published his scholarly work in a number of publications, and does a lot of speaking on this very subject. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So as far as single-sex public education goes, would you argue that the schools should be set up that way, or that we should have some of each and we should give parents the opportunity to choose? Or what if you had, in an ideal world, what would that?
Yeah, we think parents should have the opportunity to choose. And as I said to the previous caller, it's extraordinary when you look at Americans who have broken new ground, done things that no American has ever done before, whether that's Rosa Parks or Dr. Sally Ride or Dr. Madeleine Albright. It's extraordinary how often these people are graduates of girls' schools or boys' schools, especially when you consider that fewer than 1% of Americans have any experience with girls' schools or boys' schools. And yet these schools are widely available to people who have the money. Certainly in my own neighborhood in Montgomery County, Maryland, we have about a dozen single-sex private schools that charge between $23,000 and $30,000 a year. But if you don't have that kind of cash, you don't have that option. And we formed this association in January 2002, really based on our belief that parents should have a choice, not that every parent or every child should be in a single-sex school, certainly not. But parents should be the ones to make that decision, and that something like that range of options ought to be available in the public sector. Certainly it should not be prohibited in the public sector when it is so successful and widely available in the private sector.
All right. Well, we have a number of other callers here. We'll try to get in as many as we can. But again, we're really getting into our last 15 minutes, so the callers will help us, please, by trying to be brief. Let's go to line one in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I would point out that I don't know whether you're right or wrong, but I would point out that in the that recently in the Observer in England, they came to the opposite conclusion and said it was a myth that same-sex schools benefited either girls or boys for the exact reason you just said. They said that the main reason for the better performance was that they were generally fee-paying with the pupils drawn from more privileged backgrounds, which would also explain why some of these leaders, national leaders, you know, are where they are. But I wanted to ask you a more specific question. As I understand it, you're saying that, I'm sorry, that when they get older, when you're talking about adults, there is less difference to talk about. Is that correct?
Referring to the study specifically of the various regions of the brain, now the differences in the eyes, the ears, and olfactory system actually get bigger as we get older, so that a man and woman see and hear and smell very differently. Those differences do not go away. But if you look at the brain differences between a 40-year-old man and a 40-year-old woman are significantly smaller than the brain difference between a 12-year-old girl and a 12-year-old boy.
But you're not... I was looking specifically at what was claimed by a Professor Janet Hyde at the University of Wisconsin.
Janet Shibley Hyde.
Yeah, she talked about that men and women are really much more similar in personality,
yes,
communication, cognitive ability, and leadership.
Yes, which are all parameters that are not not the parameters that I address. And that indeed has been the red herring of the last 30 years. People have looked for sex differences in cognition, sex differences in personality. And in those parameters, the ones that Janet Shibley Hyde stresses, there is substantial overlap between the sexes, and the mean difference between the sexes is not large. But it turns out that if you direct your attention instead to sex differences in sensation and perception, that then the differences are enormous, that they can be orders of magnitude with no overlap between the variables.
Right, right. I see that in my personal relationship with ships, too, because I'm often told I don't listen, but it's very difficult to hear my wife's voice in particular in some situations. She just doesn't seem to get that. But, okay, I just wanted to clarify that. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go to the next, and that would be in Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hello. Well, I'm sure glad you have this show. My significant other is on the other radio listening to it because we've had a number of discussions about this situation. I'm an ex-teacher. And this is anecdotal, and I thought you might give me some guidance on this. I didn't get it at the beginning, so I didn't know what you said about teaching math to girls and boys of 11 and 12 years old, but I had a girl in sixth grade who had been passed all the way from the first and never knew how to add, subtract, multiply, or divide. And somehow I got to her, and she was a farm girl, and I just vaguely remember using a swinging gate for the hogs going in and hogs going out to get that to her. And then one day the lights turned on, and from then on, she could add, subtract, multiply. And I don't know what the hell I did. I thought you might be able to give me some general guidance on how I pulled it off.
Well, I don't know that particular girl's case. But, again, the key point is that the different regions of the brain develop in different sequence. And
mm-hmm.
The girl who finds algebra very difficult at age 12 may find it very, very easy 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is there's been such an acceleration of the curriculum and a lack of awareness of these gender differences that that girl 2 years later is unlikely to sign up for algebra unless she has
to.
Yeah,
that's true.
The result is that you've got girls in this country sign up for AP Spanish instead of calculus.
Yeah.
And if you look nationwide in the United States, you'll find that in AP Physics, you've got about four boys for every one girl.
Yeah.
And in AP Spanish, you've got about four girls for every one boy.
Yeah.
Now, that is not because boys can't learn Spanish. They can. It's not because girls can't excel in AP Physics. They can and do.
Yeah.
And at girls' schools, they typically will outperform the boys.
Yep.
In physics. But many people, like one of the callers earlier, are very upset, angered, by this notion that there are hardwired differences between the sexes, and they often will resort to ad hominem arguments.
Yes.
That you personally are somehow motivated to mislead the public in this regard. And it's unfortunate, and what we say to those people is, look, before you start attacking me or our association, why don't you read this study by Dr. Pamela Dalton? Why don't you read Dr. Edwin Leppard's research? Why don't you read the work on the cochlea, the inner ear, in girls and boys? And once you're familiar with this research showing that girls and boys do, in fact, see, hear, and smell in profoundly different ways, then let's talk about whether the best strategy in school is to ignore those differences and pretend that girls and boys see and hear in the same way, so that the boys are falling asleep in first grade and the girls think the physics teacher is yelling at them,
mm-hmm.
or whether instead a better strategy might be to be aware of this new research and use it so that we've got more girls studying physics and more boys studying art and poetry and music.
Speculative question. Has anyone ever evaluated the survival effects of this, these differences that are hardwired in terms of, evolution?
Well, certainly. That was actually the focus of our symposium last year. Or to restate your question, why is it the case that looking all around the mammals, not just at primates, but at rodents and dogs and cats, we find similar sex differences? What is so advantageous from an evolutionary perspective in having males and females see, hear, and smell in different ways? And what we came up with, and what I think is probably the right answer, is that diversity is adaptive. If every man saw the world the same as every woman, that's not as adaptive as if men and women are seeing different aspects of the landscape differently. That having different pairs of eyes see differently is probably more adaptive to the species than having all the eyes built exactly the same. And the same argument can be made with regard to hearing and even with regard to smell, that experiencing the world differently creates more diversity within a species, and diversity is better than if everyone is the same.
Well, why, just quickly then ask the question, why, though, would that break down along gender lines? Why not just say, why wouldn't it also be, might be the case that half the men would be the one way and half the men would be the other way in the same way?
If you think about the mechanics of reproduction, it's much easier to program that sort of difference when you have a chromosome that is unique to one sex, as we do. Now, back when I was in medical school 25 years ago, we were taught that the Y chromosome has very little function other than to make penis and testicles. That turns out not to be based on evidence. That was just based on the observation that women don't have Y chromosomes, and they were believed to do everything the same as men do. But we now know that the Y chromosome is widely expressed throughout the brain, and that a number of male-specific activities and behaviors that are expressed specifically in the brain are traced to the Y chromosome. Likewise, we now know that on the X chromosome, there are about 300 genes that are expressed only in women and 100 genes that are expressed only in men. And that was only discovered last year because until very recently, it didn't occur to people that the X chromosome might be expressed very differently in men and women. But it is, and that seems to be one mechanism whereby nature selects for this variation within a species.
Let's talk again with another caller. Champagne next, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Thanks for taking the call. I want to say first that I appreciate having multiple perspectives on the question, although I do admit to being very suspicious when we talk about segregating for whether it's for good purposes or for negative purposes. But my question is, because we know from other scientific studies that culture influences a child's development from very early on, and we also know that changes in the brain can actually reflect cultural experiences, such that, you know, you talked about a little bit earlier that males and females become very similar in certain things, but other things are much more different when they're adults. And I was wondering whether that might not actually be an artifact of cultural differences, that because girls and boys are raised differently, they develop their senses and things like that differently, and therefore do show differences, but that it's in fact a cultural artifact and not a biological one. But so
yeah, that's why it's so important to read the primatology research, which I cite at length in the book. So, for example,
I'm going to hang up so that I can hear, because I'm part of hearing, and so I wouldn't be able to hear you on the phone
okay.
very well. Well, but I just wanted to say one other thing what I wondered is whether these types of studies are replicated in vastly different cultures, because, are boys and girls different in the same ways in non-Western cultures as what you're reporting in Western cultures. So I'll hang up so that I can hear. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, indeed. And when we talk about sex differences in the eye, I made a special effort to cite work done in East Asia, and particularly in Japan, showing that, indeed, girls and boys differ in their visual systems, cited at length the work of Yasumasa Arai in Japan. And, indeed, the work on the cochlea was led by a Japanese team, Hiro Akisato, led that team of three Japanese researchers, showing that the cochlea is built very differently in males and females. But more even than cross-cultural studies, look at cross-species studies. So, for example, this question as to why do boys choose trucks and girls choose dolls? 10 years ago, people would have said, well, boys get cues that boys are supposed to choose trucks and girls get cues that they're supposed to choose dolls. But then when you look at research from the Yale Child Study Center showing that the same difference is found among young monkeys, and that male monkeys overwhelmingly prefer to play with trucks rather than dolls, it's hard to argue that that preference among male monkeys is due to the fact that their mother is telling them that male monkeys should play with trucks rather than dolls. There's no evidence that that is the case, and indeed the mother is not present in those studies. And that, again, I think is why primatology is so important for a variety of the aspects of sex differences. Another one where primatology, I think, is very important is risk-taking. We know that boys are much more likely to die drowning than girls are by about 5 to 1, about 5 times as many young men die in drowning accidents than women. Is that because girls are better swimmers? No, it's because if you imagine a sign on the beach saying, don't swim here, dangerous undertow, boys tend to ignore that warning and the girls heed it. And again, you might say, well, that's because they watch Spider-Man and movies like that that teach children that boys take ridiculous risks while the girls sit shivering waiting to be rescued by a male savior. And that's a very plausible argument until you read the primate research showing that the same difference in risk-taking applies to male and female monkeys. The male monkeys will plunge across the abyss, and the females very wisely go around to where there's a bridge. And I cite this work and the various primate studies demonstrating that fact. And I don't believe these old monkeys ever saw the movie Spider-Man or anything like it. These were monkeys living in the wild. So I think it is important to look not only across cultures but across species and determine whether the sex differences we observe in learning and how males and females hear and see are conserved not only across cultures but indeed across species. I said another paper by Elizabeth Lonsdorf, anthropologist, who spent 4 years in the wilds of Tanzania watching chimpanzees and found that male and female chimpanzees learn from elders in profoundly different ways, which are extraordinarily reminiscent of the differences that we observe in different cultures as to how girls and boys learn.
We're almost out of time. We have about a minute. Given what you just said, is it possible to say something about what you can do to discourage boys from doing extremely risky things and perhaps encourage girls to try to take those risks, to take appropriate risks.
Yes, indeed. Well, that is one of the longest chapters in the book, and I don't want to try and condense it into a sentence, except that to tell people that if you ignore the gender differences, you'll end up with boys who are riding their skateboard off of a ledge onto the concrete 10 feet below, and the girls who are not taking risks when they should. But your listeners can get more information at our website, whygendermatters.com.
All right. Well, at that, I think we'll finish. Our guest this morning, Dr. Leonard Sachs, he is a psychologist and MD, founder of the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education, and the book, if you would like to read it, it's now out in paperback. It's Why Gender Matters, What Parents and Teachers Need to Know About the Emerging Science of Sex Differences. And Dr. Sachs, thank you very much for talking.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, first broadcast August 28th. Many past programs from Focus, also the Afternoon Magazine, all of our local production available on our website. You can listen anytime you like. Go to will.uiuc.edu. In the next hour, another archive, also from August, this conversation with journalist Julie Phillips. We talked about her biography of Alice Sheldon, who wrote on science fiction under the pen name James Tiptree Jr. Support for the show comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine in Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the series collector to the first-time buyer. New fall selections are in stock. Wine tastings held Fridays from 5 to 7, Saturdays from 2 to 6. Beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at 337-7704 or on the web at corkscrew.com. This program, Focus 580, is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has now opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. Coming up later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, for more than 100 years, British homemakers have turned to Mrs. Beaton for domestic advice. Isabella Beaton's Book of Household Management was first published in 1861. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we will rebroadcast an interview with Catherine Hughes, author of The Short Life and Long Times of Mrs. Beaton. Ed Kieser will also be here in the noon hour for a Talk to Ed segment. You can get a forecast for places you might travel around the country. That's all part of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host for the show, and it begins here at noon on AM 580. Well, coming up very shortly here, we'll have news from National Public Radio. First, though, an update on the markets and with the numbers. Here's Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Let's take a look at how things are going today. In Kansas City, December wheat trading at 520, that contract up 7. In Chicago, December wheat 498, up 11 and 3 quarters. March 518, up 11 and 3 quarters. December corn 367 and a half, up 4 and 3 quarters. March 383 and 3 quarters, up 5 and a half. May 388 and a half, up 5 and a quarter. And December corn 359 and a quarter, up 8. January beans 683 and a half, up 9 and a half. March 696 and a half, up 9 and 3 quarters. May 705, up 8 and 3 quarters. November 724 and a half, up 8 and a half. December meal 195.20, up 3.10. December oil 28.95, up 8. At the Merck, January feeder cattle, that contract trading at 98.85, down 35.